Hi, I'm Mark Brody, and this is the Friday Newscap Podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
My name is Ruben Gallego. I'm a husband, a Marine, a father, and a proud Arizonan. And with the results we saw tonight, your next senator from the great state of Arizona.
As for me, well, I can say for certain that truth will never stop mattering to me. You will never stop mattering to me.
We have been analyzing Project 2025 for months now. I am reorganizing some things inside this office to be ready for this, including and especially my Solicitor General's office. So we're taking it very, very seriously.
We are stronger than ever before right now. The last election cycle has shown it, where the Democrats have spent tens of millions of dollars to try to flip the chambers, but they've done so unsuccessfully.
We literally mirrored federal law. So the difference is Biden was not enforcing the law. Trump is going to enforce the law.
As governor, I have and will continue to stand up against actions that hurt our communities, but I will work with anyone who is doing what's right for Arizona.
And joining me to talk about the resolution of some outstanding races, the election of new leadership at the state capitol, and more are Daniel Scarpinato of Winged Victory Agency. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning.
And Stacey Pearson of Lumen Strategy. Stacey, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Stacey, let's start with the U.S. Senate race. Ruben Gallego, as we heard, declared victory. Carrie Lake kind of conceded, I guess. She sent out a video that kind of acknowledged that she was going to move on to something else. This seems like it was kind of, if not the, then the biggest bright spot for Democrats this election cycle.
Oh, for sure. It was a very big bright spot. And I would say that concession speech sounded more like you told AI to write a concession speech. I mean, it was the strangest assembly of words a candidate could put together. And so I think Carrie Lake, her defeat underscores how much the Arizona electorate doesn't want to see her representing us.
Yeah. So, Daniel, in that video, she talked a little bit about what is next for her. We heard that. But she didn't really say what is next for her. Is this the end of the electoral road for her, do you think, in Arizona?
Possibly. I think that I was one who felt that this cycle she had a better campaign and a more disciplined message than the race in 22 for governor. And, you know, at the end of the day, she actually stepped backward in terms of the final result here in a year that, you know, has ended up to be a Republican wave year.
Yeah.
So there were a number of factors on that. Clearly, the weight of message. I mean, Ruben Gallego was up on television starting, I think, in April with a very positive message about himself. And she had some headwinds and challenges, including, you know, lack of support from the national level or people coming in late. So, you know, yes, look, running for office is difficult. She's been doing this now for 3.5 years. So I imagine there'll be some self-reflection of, you know, what now. But there's a lot of opportunities, I believe, for Republicans in this state in 2026. And I think people are going to be looking at, you know, some fresh faces out there.
So is it, would you expect her to maybe try to run for governor again, or do you think maybe not?
You know, I don't know. That's up to her. But I thought that, you know, I know that some folks said, oh, she didn't concede or whatever. I mean, I thought the tone of the video was a much more conciliatory and positive tone. And I got the sense that, you know, maybe she's going to be looking at things other than running for office was my takeaway.
All right. So, Stacey, we saw over the last, you know, week and a half or so, the Gallego was consistently on top, but the margins were sort of fluctuating. He was up by a lot. He was, you know, Lake sort of cut into that. She cut into it more. He was up by a lot. I'm wondering if at the end of the day, and we still don't have all the votes, you know, we don't have all the details yet, but do you think the result of this race says more about Ruben Gallego or Carrie Lake?
So it says quite a bit about both. Which I know is kind of a dance around answer, but the truth is there are 100,000 fewer registered Democrats today than there were 4 years ago. So the fact that Rubin won by the margin that he did, or that it looks like he's going to, which is just under 100,000 votes, is extraordinary. It means Republicans, independents broke for him over her. And that says a lot about the discipline of his campaign and his fundraising prowess and the fact that he was able to define himself as a Marine. And that her stunts with the election denialism and that Capone's vault stunt where they were trying to unseal a divorce record that had absolutely nothing juicy in it didn't work. And the electorate saw through that. I think in large part, folks want to get back to the basics. And Rubin's ability to tack to the center certainly carried the state.
Well, so you know, you mentioned that how Gallego won a number of Republicans and independents. And for so long, we've been talking about this for Democrats as the Kyrsten Sinema playbook, the Mark Kelly playbook, to some extent, the Katie Hobbs playbook. Do you think that Gallego really used that, or did he maybe adjust it somewhat? Because he was coming from a far more left-leaning perspective than any of the other three, at least most recently.
Well, you look at some of the endorsements that he received, so that really underscore that he did exactly that, that he tacked to the center, used that playbook. He got an Arizona Police Association endorsement. In years previous, there would have been Democrats that didn't accept that endorsement. That obviously has evolved. And so endorsements like that matter when the margins are going to be as close as we knew they were going to be.
So, Daniel, given that, and given, as Stacey said, the Republicans' registration advantage in Arizona going up, is this, and I love asking people to wade into the internal politics of the other side, is this sort of, does this sort of playbook, will this, do you think, continue to work or maybe be the way that Democrats have to run in Arizona, at least statewide or maybe countywide, in order to get elected?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it has been the playbook. I think, you know, they've run as an independent voice. It's all the same playbook. Now, I think what will be fascinating is Rubén Gallego as a U.S. senator, because he is much more, at least recently, progressive than Kyrsten Sinema was, than Mark Kelly. I think that's who he is in his heart. And he is now following two one-term U.S. senators who basically got railroaded by the politics of their party and of the moment.
Jeff Flake and Kyrsten Sinema.
Correct. And so, you know, he is succeeding them. And I think it will be interesting to see, is he more like a Kyrsten Sinema? Is he more like a Rubén Gallego? And how can he navigate the politics of these next 6 years? And what does that look like? I think that he, in many ways, was a very good candidate for the Democrats. He appealed across party lines. He raised a lot of money. There also were some cracks. I thought in the debate, you know, he didn't perform off the charts. I also think if he's wise, he will make himself available these next 6 years. I mean, I thought I'm a fan of Kyrsten Sinema in many ways, but I was always struck by the fact that both her and Jeff Flake didn't really do any Arizona media, didn't make the rounds, didn't do town halls. And I think that that's kind of what the public expects now, is a level of accessibility. Why are you voting this way, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you think that with Gallego and the Democrats in the Senate in the minority, does that perhaps change the way he votes, change the way he acts, than it would have been if Democrats had stayed in the majority?
It certainly does. And it certainly, not only the Democrats being in the minority in the Senate, but in the House having no control over the Supreme Court, having lost the White House, it's going to have to be very deliberative. And Rubin has shown the ability to do that. I mean, he was allowed to be as progressive as he wants to be in a district that was as safe as the one that he came from in the House, mm-hmm. that is now being represented by the woman they painted as MAGA in a primary. And so this, I think the evolution of the Latino vote in Arizona, I think the loss of Democrats just in net registration, the growth of the Republican Party, the growth of the number of independents, I think is going to put him in a position where if he wants to not go down in the same fate that his two predecessors have, he's going to continue to represent the plurality of Arizona, not just the progressive.
And let's not forget, which is why I think this will be so interesting to see what kind of U.S. senator. The reason Kyrsten Sinema won't be a U.S. senator is because of him. He pushed her out, And he came in, and the whole debate about the filibuster was really what allowed him to catapult and block her out. And so how does he navigate this, and how progressive will he be? How much will he be pushing back against some of those institutional guards that she was such a fan of?
Let me ask you before we go to break, Daniel. We got some resolution on two congressional races that were considered competitive, that were close for a while. David Schweikert and Wences Kamani both reelected. Were you surprised by either of these or the ultimate margins, which in the end don't seem as close as maybe some people thought they could be?
I really wasn't. I mean, I was very involved in Wences Kamani's race. I live in David Schweikert's district. Juan's margin, which is at this point around 3 points, I think that's where it'll land, was exactly how we tracked things the last several weeks on that campaign. And I think that for in those races in particular, because there were some congressional races that Democrats were able to flip across the country, I think it was a candidate quality issue in both of those races. And also, there was so much advertising in Arizona. So the Democrats outraised and outspent Republicans pretty much across the board. But there was so much clutter. And I often wondered those last few weeks, is anyone seeing this stuff? Is anyone hearing it? And I think the answer was they really weren't. It just became noise in Arizona because it was so overwhelming.
Stacey, what did you make of those?
Well, I also live in Schweikert's district, and I thought that the attack ads against Amish were wildly effective. I mean, he had recent votes on public safety issues that didn't align with a district that is freaked out about homelessness and crime writ large. Everybody's got a Ring camera. Phones are buzzing all the time because, you know, random man's walking down the street and my neighbors are freaking out. So I thought that was really effective. I didn't see the same level of attack against Schweikert, against the incumbent. And not only did he have a number of bad votes when he was a state legislator, but he's taken some weird positions at the federal level as well. And that just didn't cut through, to Daniel's point. And maybe it was fundraising, maybe it was strategy, maybe it was, you know, I was just in the wrong house that wasn't being targeted. But there was something missing, I think, in the level of communication with voters in the district after the primary, because Amish ran a really fantastic primary.
And a crowded primary,
very
too.
Very crowded.
Stacey, the Democrats and Governor Hobbs spent a lot of money, a lot of time to try to win control of one or both legislative chambers. In the end, the Democrats lost seats. At this moment, it's going to be 17-13 in the Senate for Republicans, 33-27 in the House, if my math is correct. What happened?
Well, to paraphrase what Senator Sinema said a few months ago, voters aren't buying what she's selling, what we're selling at the moment. And it was part of a national wave. I mean, look at Gretchen Whitmer lost control of both the House and the Senate in Michigan. Mm-hmm. So lots of strange or lots of change happened in state houses across the country. So I don't think there's any sum of money that the governor could have spent that would have solved this problem. And this is a situation familiar to both the governor from her time as a legislator and her chief of staff, Chad Campbell, who was the House minority leader with similar margins. They're in a position that is familiar to them, that they're going to be able to operate in successfully. And I think we're going to have an interesting couple of years.
So, Daniel, these margins are somewhat similar to what you and Governor Ducey worked with when he was in office and you were working for him. Does it change? Like, does having one or two extra seats in a chamber, does that really change the calculus at all?
Changes it big time. When you have one seat majorities, everyone is in charge. Everyone is the deciding
vote.
And also, by expanding these majorities on the Republican side, it means that you have more folks who are inclined to be common sense, who ran on working with both parties, who are interested in issues like transportation and water and education and things that are not on their face partisan. So that's a good thing. I think that the challenge is that what Stacey's saying is accurate, which is it might be that the governor could have spent twice as much or three times as much and it wouldn't have changed the outcome. But she did put a lot of time and money into this, and there is some bad blood because she went really aggressive after some of the people who I think would be most inclined to work and see eye to eye with the Ninth Floor. And so what my message to them would be is take the time. You know, Chad knows some of these people personally. Take the time. Go have drinks with them. Go have lunch with them. And show some humility and find those issues that you can see eye to eye on and kind of accept that there's some you can't. But I think they're going to have to do some diplomacy because there is some bad blood and hurt feelings for members who had, in some cases, $1 million spent against them with pretty aggressive advertising.
Is that something that, I mean, is that something that is on the minds of the Ninth Floor, do you think, trying to mend fence? I know when Chad Campbell, who you used to work with,
right,
went to take that job, there's a lot of discussion among Republicans in the legislature. Okay, look, we have somebody who's done this job. We know somebody that we know, somebody we can work with and communicate with. Do you get the sense this is something that the Ninth Floor is thinking about, mending fences and trying to maybe work toward getting some stuff done together?
So what I can say is that the governor spent a considerable amount of time calling all of the victors in the election last week, so Republicans, Democrats, County Board of Supervisors, top to bottom. I was surprised to see how well that was received. I mean, there were a number of tweets from folks that didn't expect to get a call from her, a congratulatory call. So certainly that's the approach is, look, we're all back on the same team. Of course, the governor of Arizona was going to try to flip a chamber in her image. And elections are always remarkably unpleasant. So I think, yes, there will be bridge building. And for the good of Arizona, we need this all to work.
Daniel, the legislators who were elected their leadership this week. In the Senate, things will stay more or less the same at the top with President Warren Peterson. In the House, Steve Montenegro, who's in his second stint in the legislature, will be taking over as Speaker. The former Speaker, Ben Thoma, of course, left to run for Congress this year. Does that make any difference, having someone like Steve Montenegro running the House as opposed to anyone else?
I think really well of Steve. I worked for him actually when he was Speaker Pro Tem in two previous lives ago. and he is someone who I think will bring some real seriousness to this job. I think him and Warren Peterson will make a great team. I do think there's a lot of issues to see eye to eye on. And I also think that he will be a great communicator to folks about the Republican agenda, particularly the Hispanic community. I haven't seen this reported, but I believe he might be the first Hispanic Speaker of the House. And I think that's a big deal. So I think there's a lot of real positive things that have come out of this, and it's a fresh start, even though he's been around for a while, two different stints at the Capitol.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of a fresh face and a fresh start for the House Republican caucus.
So we talked about the difference of having maybe a one-seat majority versus a two- or more-seat majority. In terms of a first-time speaker, he's been in leadership, as you referenced, mm-hmm. but for a first-time speaker, how helpful might it be that it's not, for him, a one-seat majority where everybody is the deciding vote?
I think it's hugely helpful. Also, what is unique about him is that he is – you rarely have a speaker who becomes speaker so early in their tenure. So he has 6 years now that he could serve as speaker. And that's a big deal. You haven't seen that in a very long time. And so I think that both in terms of the experience he brings, the ability for him to not be in this kind of, I've got 2 years, you know, Ben Thoma was immediately a lame duck when he became Speaker of the House, as were several of his predecessors. So I think there's a lot of positives from this.
Stacey, I'm curious what you make of the leadership that the Democrats elected in the House, Oscar de los Santos, and the Senate, Priya Sundarajan, two people who had been in leadership positions but not sort of at the top.
So I think there are a number of reasons those folks make sense. One being that they do represent a more progressive wing of the caucus. And to get those folks on board with a number of the governor's policy priorities is going to be extraordinarily important. And then geographically, we've got Southern Arizona representation, Maricopa County representation. It's important. We're not facing the same issues across the state from north to south. So it's helpful to have folks there.
I'm curious, though, and we saw the Arizona Freedom Caucus this week send out a press release basically calling both of them communists. And, you know, take that for what it's worth. But like, does that affect the Democrats' ability to either work with Republicans or like sort of get their message out when, you know, already before they're even sworn into their terms, you know, they have people on their side calling them communists?
It's cuckoo. That's cuckoo. But when you look at this in terms of who's covering what flank, the governor and Chad Campbell can certainly cover the moderates. And to have those leaders cover the left flank is extraordinarily important.
Well, two comments on this. One is we talked about, okay, Republicans have a little bit larger majority, what that means in terms of some breathing room. So the flip side is that now there are no moderates in the Democratic caucus because they lost all the swing seats. And so the caucus will be much more progressive. I think you saw that in these leadership races. I mean, in terms of looking for people who are going to bring decorum to the body, I'm not sure that this was the choice given, particularly in the House. I think that, again, thinking through how does the governor navigate this, she was elected with 13% of Republicans voting for her. I think for her to succeed in 2 years, she has to extend an olive branch. She has to demonstrate that she is working with Republicans on some things because, as Stacey has rightly pointed out, it's math. There aren't enough Democrats to win statewide without winning Republican swing voters. So that is going to be a very important element for her success and, frankly, for Adrian Fontes and Chris Mays in 2026.
So I have about 25 seconds for each of you. I want to just end quickly. Do you think that the legislature and the governor will be able to get stuff done given the margins and given the people involved in this?
Oh, I absolutely do.
What do you think, David?
They have no choice. They have to pass a budget. They have to finish. This isn't Washington, D.C. We have actual responsibilities here.
All right. We'll leave it there. Daniel Scarpinato, Stacey Pearson, thanks you both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate
Thank you.
It. Thank you. You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's biggest stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.